Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's a rare day in Washington. A bipartisan budget is on the verge of passing, at least in the Senate, which is expected to approve a two-year budget plan that will add $300 billion to the deficit, but keep the government from shutting down at midnight. It has gotten a cold shoulder in the House, though, from members of both parties. Yesterday, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi gave an eight-hour marathon speech railing against the bill because it doesn't address the fate of young immigrants known as the Dreamers. This morning, she said her vote is no.
This agreement, which I fought very hard for many of the things that are in there, and I think that it's a good bill. It's unfortunate that it's taking place in an insulting way to those of us who are trying to protect the values of our country.
Well, NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow joins us now. And Scott, some Republicans are also openly asking, you know, what happened to their party's promise to rein in a ballooning national deficit. Talk about what the bill does. Ups military spending, extends a CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program.
Yeah, it does a lot of things. It's kind of an old-fashioned Washington deal here that has a lot of things that a lot of people like in both parties. It increases funding for disaster relief, $90 billion for disaster relief. There's $6 billion over the next two fiscal years for opioid treatment efforts, $4 billion to deal with VA backlogs, a lot of things that members in both parties not only like but are eager to report back to constituents saying, hey, we got this. This also does something important. It would increase the debt limit to March 2019, notably past the next election, taking away another big, you know, ticking deadline moment that's always a tough bill to pass in Congress.
How did this happen? Because we know on the immigration bill that lawmakers are trying to hammer out, there's that Common Sense Coalition, a group of lawmakers that meets in Maine Senator Collins' office. Lindsey Graham is calling it Switzerland. But how did this happen on the spending side?
Well, there were meetings between the four congressional leaders, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and Nancy Pelosi's offices were all involved in this. One thing that's notable that Schumer said on the Senate floor earlier today was that the White House was not really involved in these negotiations, and he said that that allowed them to be more serious negotiations without some of the drama and twists and turns and changing priorities that happen when President Trump is at the negotiating table. So these were the leaders from all parties sitting down. I think there had been increasing frustration of going from short-term spending bill to short-term spending bill. There's always a lot of partisan politics involved, but leaders on all sides of the aisle don't like going from short term to short term. They want to be able to provide some stable funding for the federal government.
Well, as we know, Chuck Schumer in the Senate says, you know, look, not everyone's going to be happy, but he is a fan of the bill. We know Nancy Pelosi is not. That 8-hour speech in high heels, as people are pointing out. What's happening on the Democratic side? Is this a good cop, bad cop, or is this real division?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is frustrated, and a lot of House Democrats are frustrated because they view the funding measures as the minority party's only real chance of leverage to get some sort of resolution for people in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, which is set to expire in less than a month now. So this is a funding bill that has come and gone without any sort of resolution for DACA. So I think that's why you saw Pelosi on the floor trying to prove to her constituents, trying to prove to immigration activists that she still cares about this, that Democrats still care about this. One thing is notable, though. Pelosi this morning said she will be voting against it, but she was asked, and are you telling your entire caucus to vote against this? Are you saying this is a key vote that you're going to whip votes on? And she indicated that is not the case. So I think you'll have some Democrats voting no, some Republicans voting no, but Paul Ryan seems pretty confident that he has enough votes to get this passed.
He also said today that he'd be open to debate on the Dreamers and that there's a commitment to solving the DACA challenge in both parties, but pass this first. So it goes on to the House, and you have the Republicans who are, many of the Republicans in the House, angry about how this just balloons the deficit. So what is your sense of what's going to happen?
Well, I think it's what I said before, that that there's enough votes to get this passed, but you certainly have loud factions in both parties who are frustrated that that, you know, on the Republican side, that this really does up spending. This blows through the or gets rid of, rather, the spending caps that were put in place way back in 2011 and in, you know, several impasses previous to this one. But you know, Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi are keeping track of how many votes they have because nobody seems to want another government shutdown. Democrats viewed the one that happened a few weeks ago as by and large a political disaster.
Right.
So it's likely this will pass.
NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
And on that issue of the deficit, how much does the deficit really matter? Maybe not as much as you think, according to economist Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University and former chief economist for the Senate Budget Committee Democratic staff. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And leaving aside what's in the budget proposal, which you may have some issues with, from a deficit perspective, do you care that it adds hundreds of billions of dollars to the federal debt?
No, I don't care that it adds to the federal debt. What I care about is whether the addition to the deficit is the kind of thing that you would do in order to promote an economic agenda that includes, you know, delivering a more balanced and sustainable economy. I care whether the deficit is pushing an economy that's already too close to full employment, that there might be some inflationary problems that may arise, but adding to the national debt would not be my concern.
Why not? Why is that not a concern for you, given the fact that we're talking about, what, close to $20 trillion in debt at this point for the United States?
When I look at the national debt, I say the debt is really nothing more than the dollars the government spent into the economy and didn't tax back over the nation's history. Somehow we've managed to convince the population, and when I say we, I mostly mean politicians and pundits talking about the national debt. We've managed to convince the ordinary American that the federal debt somehow belongs to them in a way that puts them in debt. So you hear people say things like, your share of the national debt. You know, every man, woman, and child owes $60,000 in debt. This is really silly because the federal government's debt is not our obligation. It's not our liability. In fact, the federal government's debt is nothing more than the U.S. Treasury bonds that lots of people hold in their portfolios, and they consider them not their liabilities, but their assets. And so these are really important investment vehicles. They're assets to the people who hold those bonds. And like I said, they're nothing more than the dollars the government spent into the economy and didn't tax back out.
So why not just have $100 trillion in debt then?
Well, you know, maybe one day, hundreds of years from now, we will. And if you look at a country like Japan, they're closing in on, are you ready for this, a quadrillion in debt. So the numbers sound very big, and big numbers can sound scary to people. 20 trillion sounds like a lot. I would say, remember, the national debt is the asset to the people who hold it. If the government spends 100 into the economy and it only taxes 90 back out, it's run a deficit. Now, under current law, the government requires itself to do this thing called borrowing whenever it deficit spends, which just means that it allows somebody in the economy who's sitting there holding $10 that the government spent in through its deficit spending, it allows that person to swap that $10 out for a U.S. Treasury, which is kind of a nice deal for the person who gets to make that trade because they end up with an interest-bearing asset instead of just that cash dollar that they're holding that doesn't pay them any interest. So I think we get really worked up and scared, and we think of the government's debt as somehow akin to household debt, and it's really nothing like that.
And what about the lenders? A lot of our debt is owned by China. Are you worried that one day they'll want us to pay up?
No, because they're not callable bonds. So China doesn't just get to say, pay us back. And the real question is, why does China have all those bonds in the first place? Well, mostly it's because China manufactures things and sells them to the United States, and we do less of that to China. So in other words, we run a big trade deficit with China, and that means that China ends up holding lots of dollars. And what those dollars are to China is just think of it as a checking account at the Federal Reserve Bank. So China gets a bank statement from the Fed, and we get, you know, boatloads of stuff coming in from China. Now, what China does is say, we don't want to hold our money, we don't want to hold our dollars in this checking account at the Fed. We'd prefer to hold it in a savings account. That's a securities account. All they do is swap their checking account into U.S. Treasuries. And we call that borrowing from China. But to the extent that China wants to continue to accumulate dollars because it wants to export their goods to us, they're going to end up holding more treasuries. The only way to really unwind that is for China to one day decide that they actually don't want to manufacture things for the U.S.
What do you make of the polling on this? A Pew Research poll this year found just under half of Americans said the budget deficit should be a top priority for the president and Congress, which is down from nearly two-thirds in 2014. Why do you think the public opinion appears to be shifting on this?
I think that it's good news, and I think public opinion is shifting because public opinion is so shaped by what we hear our leaders in Washington, policymakers, pundits talking about. And as the rhetoric dialed down on deficit hysteria, the national debt, it's reflected in the polls. People hear less concern from Washington about deficits, and it's reflected in the way people feel. They say, yeah, you know what? We should put a higher priority on job creation and growth and prosperity.
That's Stephanie Kelton, who's a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. Professor, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That's the sound of SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket taking off earlier this week. It was the first time a rocket this powerful was launched by a private company. And it took off from the same pad where NASA once carried astronauts to the moon. So what does it mean for the future of spaceflight and NASA? Lori Garver is former deputy administrator for NASA. She's now general manager of the Airline Pilots Association. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Jeremy.
And Elon Musk called the experience this week surreal. What did you think?
Oh, it was surreal, especially the landing of the two rockets that we were able to see, the outer boosters. Just the expectations were with the winds that we might not see it. And then when it cleared the tower, that was the goal. And then it went the whole way and it was quite a sight. There were a lot of tears of joy.
Quite a sight and a lot cheaper than something like this would have been in the past. A rocket this powerful might typically cost $350 million a launch or more. This one, just $90 million. How did that happen? How did they manage to do it so cheaply?
Well, the costs are tough to really even quantify, since to the taxpayer, this had zero cost.
Right.
You know, they developed this privately, and NASA is working on its own vehicle, spending more than $1 billion a year for nearly 10 years now, and isn't even there. So once you're going to operate the vehicle, that's the cost you're talking about in the comparison. They, SpaceX, say will charge $90 million a launch, and we know for the government, we would be paying, $1 billion a year and at most be able to launch it once a year. And the reasons are complicated, but have everything to do with how you procure these vehicles and what your incentives are. And, you know, the government cost plus contracting, there aren't a lot of incentives to innovate. There are incentives to make it absolutely risk-free and get a lot of contracts in a lot of different states and congressional districts, and that leads to a lot of time and a lot of cost.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that the government is typically wasting a lot of money when it does something like this.
The government is spending their money on people and infrastructure that would be unneeded if you did it privately. I know NASA for a long time has been about sustaining the workforce. So it's a little harsh to say there's no value because there are jobs. My view is those could be better jobs and more jobs, because if you're doing it commercially, you're going to be able to do a lot more. This vehicle is going to be able to launch many more times a year than we could afford to do with our own government-developed vehicles.
Are there any downsides to all of this privatization in space?
I don't think so. To me, a downside would have been if SpaceX was the only one, because you really don't want to count on one private sector company. They at some point will be able to charge whatever they want. We've seen this with United Launch Alliance, primarily on the military launch side. But we have a great situation now because we have SpaceX, and nipping at its heels is Blue Origin, and they are probably going to launch something this size in the next few years as well. We have a number of companies seriously going to be flying humans to space. There's Boeing, there's SpaceX, there's Virgin Galactic, and Blue Origin. And so the competition is what is going to drive innovation and reduction of costs. And if one of them has a hiccup that takes time to recover, someone else can step in. With the government, you don't have that. You just have single string. NASA has a great continuing role, and they should embrace it, and that is to go farther, to do the next thing. If we can launch to beyond low Earth orbit, back to the moon, onto Mars, we don't yet have landing vehicles. We don't have transfer vehicles. We don't have all the information we need on humans surviving in deep space. Huge role left for NASA, and I really hope they embrace it.
So do you think it's a mistake then that the Trump administration wants NASA to focus in part on sending astronauts back to the moon?
Not at all. I think sending astronauts back to the moon is appropriate for the government. I just think they shouldn't wait to build their own launch vehicle to do it. I would assume that you could spend the money you're developing now on the launch vehicle to build landers and the kinds of things that the rest of the lunar program would need. There might be some of that that could also benefit from competition and innovative procurement mechanisms. I don't believe it's the goal that is the problem. It's really how you go about doing it.
Was the SpaceX launch the most exciting thing in space this year, or do you think that we've got something else coming in 2018 that'll be just as interesting?
Ah, it's early in the year, isn't it? It would be great to have something more interesting. I do feel that this is a game changer, but if we launch people to the space station this year on either the Starliner, Boeing's vehicle, or Dragon, that could be equally as exciting. I think that is more likely for 19. But it is an exciting time for space. Every single hotel was sold out, and we aim to keep the American public, I think, inspired for a long time being space explorers again.
That's Lori Garver, a former deputy administrator for NASA. She's now general manager of the Airline Pilots Association. Lori, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Nice to talk to you.
The opening ceremonies for the 2018 Winter Olympics are tomorrow night in South Korea. Vice President Mike Pence is leading the U.S. delegation to the Games, and that is causing some controversy among U.S. athletes. Let's bring in Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And there are two openly gay athletes competing for the U.S. in the Olympics. One is freestyle skier Gus Kenworthy. Here he is on The Ellen Show.
We're going into the Olympics, and myself and Adam Rippon are the two first openly gay males competing in the Olympics, and it's just incredible to see how times have changed because of people like you and athletes in the past and so many people that have paved the way, but then to have someone leading the delegation that's, like, directly attacked the LGBT community and just a cabinet in general that just sort of stands against us and has tried to do things to set us back, it just seems like a bad fit.
And Adam Rippon, by the way, said he won't meet with Pence at the Games. What do you make of this?
Well, it's certainly within the rights of the athletes to do it. And I would take us back to an incident where Mike Pence went to supposedly a Peyton Manning ceremony at an Indianapolis Colts game. And as soon as players knelt, which he knew they were going to do, he showily left the stadium. So there is the vice president using a sporting event for politics. Here are sportsmen using a sporting event for politics. All seems fair to me.
Do you think that the fact that North Korean athletes are going to be participating is going to overshadow all of this?
I think not overshadow. I understand why so much of the coverage leading up to the Games is about North Korea, because before the Games, North Korea is, of course, a huge story. The Hermit Kingdom, how they will interact with the South Koreans if and how they will participate in these Games. And there was some diplomacy, which is notable. Of course, any diplomacy as opposed to militarism on that peninsula is notable. So as a news story, it's going to dominate the coverage. But once the Games begin, the North Korean athletes won't be winning many medals goals at all. So I think it will be subsumed by the actual athletic achievement.
Well, and speaking of the athletic achievement, who are you going to be watching from the U.S. team?
The U.S. women's skiers, specifically Lindsey Vonn, who is well-known, and Michaela Schifrin, who should be better known because she is the greatest female skier in the world, they should dominate their events. And the women's hockey team, either the Canadians or the Americans, will win gold in that, I predict. Also, there's a combined South Korean, North Korean women's hockey team. That'll be interesting to look for. And the Americans are very good at the freestyle skiing. So basically, we're not so great at endurance events. So basically, if it's kind of boring to watch and takes a long time to unfold, Americans aren't that interested. But if you could watch like a 45-second clip on YouTube and go, wow, Americans will be there dominating.
How is NBC handling the broadcasts because of the huge time difference between South Korea and the U.S.?
You know, it's so huge that it almost works to their advantage. Of course, they'd rather have this be, you know, somewhere on the East Coast of the United States. But it's a 15-hour time difference. So when they go into prime time at 8 o'clock, it'll be 11 o'clock over there. A lot of events will be taking place. So their prime time broadcast is not going to be tape delayed in the East and the Central, even in the West. And they had come in for criticism of that. They'll have a whole channel for curling, which everyone loves, or at least everyone loves the idea of. They have so many, I'll say it, the NBC family of networks. They have so many networks out there that they could just throw events on, CNBC for most of the day and MSNBC for some of the day and Bravo here and there. I guess if the markets fall another 1,000 points, we'll have to turn somewhere else besides the dedicated curling network to find that out now that CNBC is giving us curling.
Nobody loves curling more than public radio, by the way, Mike. I don't know how many stories I've heard over the years about curling. One more thing, just a few seconds here. But this is going to be the first Olympics since 1994 not to include current NHL hockey players.
Yes, and I think, and that saddens me. We'll see some amateurs. The Swedes will probably do well. Russia may medal. But, you know, not having the NHL. The NHL says it didn't really help the brand. It didn't drive people to the arenas. But it was just fun to watch during the Olympics. And if you think I care, the Canadians care 10 times as much.
Mike Pesca here, Now Sports Analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
Question: when did the White House know about domestic abuse allegations from two ex-wives against White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter? When they became public this week, Chief of Staff John Kelly at first praised Porter. Then, when a picture surfaced of one of the wives with a black eye, said he was shocked. But those allegations were reportedly the reason Porter did not get permanent security clearance a year ago for his job handling sensitive documents that go to the president. Joining us by Skype is Politico White House reporter Andrew Restuccia. And Andrew, what are you learning about what John Kelly knew about the FBI's vetting of Rob Porter for that clearance?
What we're learning from sources inside the administration is that the broad strokes of the allegations, including a 2010 protective order or a restraining order against Rob Porter, were not a mystery to senior administration officials and senior people in the White House, including John Kelly. The FBI conducted a background check on Mr. Porter and did not grant him a permanent security clearance because of these allegations. They were still looking into them. And John Kelly himself knew about these allegations for at least several months, if not longer, dating back to the fall. Politico reported late last night that the ex-girlfriend, this is a separate woman from the two ex-wives of Mr. Porter, actually approached the White House counsel, Don McGahn, with her concerns.
Well, and her concerns were that Rob Porter was reportedly dating Hope Hicks, and this ex-girlfriend called, again, the White House counsel with concerns about the abuse allegations from the two ex-wives.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we've confirmed as well that Mr. Porter and Hope Hicks, who's the White House communications director and one of probably the closest people to President Trump, did have a romantic relationship. It's unclear where that relationship stands at the moment.
Yeah. Well, and tell us more about Rob Porter. We know he's the son of a prominent Mormon family in Utah, relocated to Belmont, Massachusetts. Rob Porter went to Harvard. What more do we know?
Yeah, he actually went to Harvard in the same general time frame as Jared Kushner, who, of course, is married to Ivanka Trump and is also a senior advisor in the White House. He has, a very typical Republican resume. He worked for Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah. He's a Rhodes Scholar. Mm. So people in the White House, those that did not know about this past history, sort of were stunned when this news came out.
Well, it's interesting. Rob Porter, Belmont, Massachusetts, to Harvard, to the White House. John Kelly, neighboring but very different. Alston Brighton, Massachusetts, the military, the White House. Are people wondering why he so defended Rob Porter?
I've met Rob a number of times. He is a mild-mannered, sort of soft-spoken man. And I think genuinely people thought in the White House at the beginning that this couldn't be true. And I think it really hit home for people in the White House, including Kelly, when these pictures were released. And she alleges that Rob Porter punched her in the face during a trip to Italy.
By the way, Rob Porter is saying that he took that picture and that the circumstances weren't what's being described. He's not saying he did not cause the black eye.
He did release a statement yesterday denying the allegations and saying that he took the photos, but he hasn't said anything else. So it's sort of unclear what he meant by that.
But again, bottom line, officials are telling you that John Kelly was aware that a 2010 protective order was taken out against Rob Porter and hired him for that critical job anyway. Andrew Restuccia, White House reporter for Politico. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we said, Vice President Mike Pence is in South Korea for tomorrow's opening ceremonies for the Winter Olympics. Pence met today with South Korean President Moon Jae-in and reportedly expressed concern to Moon about his country's more conciliatory tone toward North Korea. Pence arrived as North Korean leader Kim Jong-un presided over an extravagant military parade in the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. Thousands of North Korean soldiers hailed Kim today as he walked past them with a salute. Joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Professor, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And North and South Korea seem to be taking steps toward diplomacy, but it does sound like Vice President Pence is maintaining more of a hard line against the North. What do you make of this moment?
Well, on this note alone, one sees that when it comes to propaganda, or to put it more politely, public diplomacy, North Korea is a notch or two above the United States.
What do you mean by that?
North Korea has been softening its image. It's been sending athletes, about 200 female cheerleaders. Kim Jong-un is now sending his younger sister. So exuding, projecting a softer image, while the U.S. vice president is saying everything that is true, of course, that North Korea is trying to use the games for propaganda. North Korea is trying to hijack the Olympics. All this is a charade. But these things don't need to be said, because if you say these things, you come across as the Grinch, as the grumpy aggressor, and that is not good PR. Vice President Pence should be careful and not repeat the mistake that John Foster Dulles, the former U.S. Secretary of State, made in 1954 in Geneva when the Chinese Premier, Zhou Enlai, extended his hand to shake hands and the American statesman just snubbed him, ignored him in front of representatives from many other countries. There is a PR debacle waiting to happen. North Korea has the momentum right now. It has made the move to wield the carrot after that ballistic year last year. And North Korea is very crafty. Sophisticated is not a word that comes to mind necessarily when we think of North Korea, but North Korea is very crafty. It knows how to wield both the carrot and the stick. And I think the U.S. should not be overly aggressive in coming across as the party pooper.
So what do you make of the military parade in North Korea today? That's not a softer image. That's the old-fashioned North Korean hardline image.
That's the Missiles Are Us parade.
Right.
And, of course, falling right on the eve of the opening ceremony of the Olympics, Kim Jong-un is showing the world, and in particular South Korea, who's the boss. However, lest the United States raise a big fuss over it, Kim Jong-un is also offering a carrot, a soothing musical performance by North Koreans in South Korea near the site of the Games, which just concluded. So again, February 8th, one sees, even today on this snapshot of a day, North Korea wielding both the carrot and the stick and getting away with it.
Do you expect Vice President Pence or any other senior U.S. official to meet with a North Korean official during the Olympics?
It could happen. I think, again, Vice President Pence doesn't want to come across as angry or grumpy. If he runs into North Koreans, he should smile, shake hands, chit-chat a little bit. And if they want a little discussion, tea time on the sidelines, he should be amenable to that. Optics are very important, and this is the world's biggest stage. Again, the United States should not come across as the petulant party.
You were born in South Korea, and of course, Seoul hosted the Summer Games back in 1988. But this is a very different time with tensions over the North's nuclear program. What did these Winter Games mean for the Koreas, do you think?
Well, it was not all that glamorous. That is, even South Koreans were not all that interested. Winter Olympics compared to the Summer Games usually don't gain as much interest or generate as much excitement. But it's really North Korea's participation that has glamorized the Winter Olympics. South Koreans 30 years ago were very sensitive to how they were portrayed by NBC or by Americans and others. It was a big coming out party hosting the Summer Games in 1988. And of course, North Korea cravenly tried to spoil that by blowing up a South Korean civilian aircraft in November 1987 to discourage athletes and visitors from coming to South Korea. The situation today is very different. It's more favorable to South Korea in terms of South Korea's status, its image in the world. At the same time, North Korea is a de facto nuclear state. So the security situation has not improved.
Do you think South Korea is playing its cards well right now in taking this more friendly approach to the North?
Well, South Korea needs to go with the flow, as should the United States for the time being. At the same time, South Korea, in my view, is bending over backwards to accommodate North Korea, going out of its way, spending a lot of money to really accord the VIP treatment to North Korea's mid-level officials, North Korean cheerleaders and musicians and dancers and so on, and violating various UN Security Council resolutions seeking waivers, exemptions. For example, a high-level North Korean official is visiting South Korea tomorrow with the high-level delegation, Choi Hui. Mr. Choi is banned, prohibited to travel overseas under a UN Security Council resolution as of last year. But South Korea is more than eager to make all these exceptions to accommodate North Korea's designs.
So after all of the pomp and circumstance is over from these Olympic Games, what do you think happens with the North Korean nuclear issue?
The North Korean nuclear program will progress, will advance, march down their own path to their own drumbeat. North Korea, even if it conducts an ICBM test or a nuclear test right in the middle of the games, and as crazy as that sounds, I think North Korea will be able to walk away scot-free because with tens of thousands of foreign visitors all assembled in South Korea, athletes from almost 100 nations and so on, what would the Trump administration do? Threaten war? I don't think so. And this goodwill, the fuzzy, warmer dynamics in the region right now will spill over into the post-Olympics era. So if Kim Jong-un were to do something naughty like that in May or June, it will still come across as an aberration. All the bluster and ballistic missile tests of last year have largely been forgotten under this, you know, new atmospherics in the region. So I think just by sending a few athletes to the games, Kim Jong-un has won himself a free pass for the next provocation and probably has laid the foundation of South Korea subsidizing North Korea, as it used to when North Korea would send hundreds of athletes and cheerleaders to the South in the early 2000s and mid-2000s. And during those heady times, the South Korean government would give North Korea almost $1 billion a year, about 70% of that, $700 million US dollars in cash. And that would be a return to the good old days. That would mean improving inter-Korean relations to Kim Jong-un.
But just to be clear, it sounds like you're saying you expect the North to launch a missile or do something like that in the middle of the games.
Not necessarily in the middle of the games, although if they do it so brazenly, no one should be surprised. They have a keen sense of timing. North Korea usually does these things on a major holiday, both American and North Korean, and even at times Chinese. So the splash created would be quite impactful if they did it right in the middle of the games. There's a major holiday coming up on February 16th, which is his late father's birthday, the second most important holiday in North Korea. This year, February 16th also happens to be New Year's Day by the lunar calendar, which North Koreans and South Koreans and Chinese and Vietnamese celebrate. And in the past, in 2013, North Korea conducted a nuclear test during Lunar New Year celebrations, which was one big, very discourteous message to Xi Jinping, his first Lunar New Year holiday as the leader of China. So no one should be surprised. But what I'm trying to say is this crescendo of goodwill will spill over into the post-Olympics period in April, May, June, July, and so forth. So even with the next nuclear test or ICBM test, people will say, hey, no human lives have been lost. There's been no destruction of property. United States, please calm down and return to negotiations. And that is exactly what Kim Jong-un seeks.
That's Sung Yoon Lee, who's a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A new bill is being considered in New Jersey that could make it the first state to ban the sale of menthol cigarettes. San Francisco passed a similar law last year. The American Cancer Society says menthols have a cooling sensation that masks the effect of smoke. But the New Jersey Food Council, a retail group, says the ban would hurt businesses like convenience stores, where menthol cigarettes make up to 35% to 40% of the store's total sales. Jonathan Folds is a professor of public health sciences and psychiatry at Penn State University. Professor Folds, remind us the difference between menthol and regular cigarettes.
The two kinds of cigarettes are very similar. The main difference is that the menthol that's added stimulates cold receptors, and it means that it reduces the harshness of the cigarette smoke, including the harshness of the nicotine. We believe that particularly in situations where people have been forced to reduce the number of cigarettes they smoke per day, perhaps due to high taxes or, you know, clean indoor air laws that limit where you can smoke. Sometimes what they have to do then is they try and inhale more smoke per cigarette. And the menthol actually seems to make that easier to do, because as you try and inhale more and larger puffs, if you're smoking regular cigarettes, that can give a harsh sensation. The menthol cools it down and makes it easier to do that.
But menthol is an additive. It's a flavor. So when in 2009 the FDA prohibited tobacco companies from selling flavors of cigarettes because they tasted better, they were more tempting, especially for younger smokers, why wasn't menthol included?
I think the main reason was that of all the flavors that people had added or thought of adding to cigarettes, menthol was the one with by far the largest market share. So in a sense, it meant that the tobacco companies would kick up a big fuss and object very strongly, and they probably did when this was being considered. And so this was given a pass, and it was to be decided by a committee and by the Food and Drug Administration. In fact, both the expert advisory committee and the FDA's own report both came to the conclusion that menthol added to cigarettes has a negative effect on public health.
Yeah, well, and there are some other issues here. They're racial and socioeconomic, because studies show that menthol cigarette marketing disproportionately targets minority and low-income communities.
Yes, and it seems when you look at the kind of the epidemiological data, any group in society that has less cash in their pocket to spend is more likely to smoke cigarettes. So, for example, young people, teenagers included, are much more likely to start on menthol cigarettes. Minorities in the United States are much more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes. Women are more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes. It's hard to tell to what extent that's due to targeted advertising or what the particular reason is, but it's a clear trend.
Well, and where are we on cigarette smoking? Do you know the percentage of Americans who are still smoking and where the biggest regions are where they are?
Regular cigarette smoking, it's now about 15% in the United States. It's been coming down steadily, but very, very gradually. Many of us in public health believe that it really is time to take more assertive steps to get it, you know, lower still. Because every year we delay causes more and more people to start smoking and more people to die of smoking-caused illnesses.
Yeah. Well, but what do you do if you ban it in one state? Won't someone just go to the next state?
Yes, that's a distinct possibility. But what it does do is it puts the idea in the other states' mind for the legislators to consider, just like we've seen with increases in cigarette tax. And somebody's got to take the leap first. I'm glad that New Jersey's doing it.
And the FDA was considering a ban on menthols in 2013. Some U.S. senators tried again last August. What are they running up against? Is it just the lobbying effort of the industry? Or is it, as we're seeing in New Jersey, small grocery owners who know that a lot of the things that they sell to people coming in to get cigarettes, who will then buy maybe a couple of, you know, sodas and a sandwich. Is it just this pushback?
I think it's partly the pushback, and it's partly, you know, from the industry and even these small business owners, their organized efforts to oppose these kind of positive changes are largely backed by the tobacco industry. But it's also the fact that the evidence is complicated. It's not the case that, you know, menthol causes cancer or any direct harms to health. Rather, it seems to make the uptake of smoking more easy for young people, which is a serious thing. It seems to make cigarettes more addictive, perhaps because it makes it easier to inhale more nicotine. And so that leads to long-term health effects. But because the evidence is a bit complicated and the effects are indirect, it's not as easy to show it with certainty, especially if you're challenged in court by the tobacco industry.
Jonathan Folds, Professor of Public Health Sciences and Psychiatry at Penn State. Professor Folds, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, he tells us, yes, the rate of cigarette smoking is falling 15%, but he has concerns about the increasing marijuana use and the health issues there. So we'll take that up another day. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.